All of the Fretboard Journal podcasts are brought to you by a few presenting sponsors. First up is Marden Guitars. Marden Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Then we have Carter Vintage Guitars over in Nashville, where guitar lovers go for a good time. And we have a brand new presenting sponsor, Calton Cases. Your custom instrument deserves a custom case. Thank you to all of our presenting sponsors. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that is John Rauhouse playing in the background. Today on the podcast, I'm welcoming returning guest, all-around great guy, incredible guitarist, Tim McGraw's acoustic guitarist, Bob Minner. Bob is one of our favorite people. He's a contributor to the magazine. He's always got interesting stories about his guitars. He's always got an interesting quiver of guitars. And he just put out a record simply called Solo that we've been playing a ton here at the Fretboard Journal since we got it a week or so ago. It officially comes out on all the streaming platforms February 5th. But you can get it now. You can get it from Bob Minner's music page. And the coolest thing about this record, in addition to being a collection of great instrumental acoustic guitar numbers arranged by Bob, is the entire album was played on a Collings CJ45. This is a guitar that was just announced. It's their slope-shouldered throwback to bygone guitars, and the guitar sounds incredible. And I love a good story where a guitarist is so inspired by an instrument that they take to writing, take to recording, and that is exactly what happened with this record. Bob also even wrote a song called Van Wart, an homage to Bruce Van Wart, who's been on this podcast, one of the unsung heroes working down in Austin, Texas at Collings Guitars. Couldn't be happier to talk to Bob. Bob's also writing a story for the Fretboard Journal. It's going to be out in one of our next issues. And speaking of our next issues, Fretboard Journal 47 is going to be showing up at our headquarters in just about 36 hours. And those are going to start mailing out to subscribers around the world within a few days. So if you haven't subscribed to the Fretboard Journal yet, now is your final warning. Subscribe. We have digital subscriptions. We also have print subscriptions. You can use the discount code podcast when you check out, and you'll even get $5 off of your subscription. And best of all, you'll be supporting all that we do, including this podcast, including the other podcasts we do, Luthier on Luthier, as well as The Truth About Vintage Amps, as well as the brand new podcast that we just launched, the baby of the group, The Truth About Recording and Mixing, where folks can send questions about all things recording, mixing, and mastering, and host Johnny Sangster will do his best to answer your questions. Bob and I talked a lot about home recording on this podcast, which was a lot of fun. I didn't expect that to happen, but Bob made a beautiful sounding record, and as you'll hear, got to thank Harbor Freight, who are not a sponsor of this podcast, but you can get all sorts of stuff at Harbor Freight, apparently, including stuff to make your acoustic guitar record sound a little bit better. In terms of sponsors that we do have, I got to give a shout out to Folkway Music, one of our favorite stores in the world, owned by another frequent Fretboard Journal podcast guest, Mark Stepman, as well as Mono Cases. You can go to monocreators.com to see all that they are up to, as well as our friends over in New York City at Retro Fret Vintage Guitars. The Cootercaster sold, folks, so you're going to have to see the rest of their inventory, and they do have some incredible guitars. And our newest sponsor is our friends at Isotope. You can use the discount code FRET10 to save 10% off your next Isotope order. Isotope makes plugins that will help clean up all those little mistakes and glitches in your home recordings or in your studio recordings. And I couldn't be happier to be using their products. As I said, the new record that we're going to be talking about is just called Solo. It's available at Bob Minner's website, which I'll include a link to in the show notes. Thank you all for tuning in. Thank you for listening to the show. Thank you for all the Apple Podcast reviews. Keep those coming. Keep sharing them. And this podcast will continue to grow, which we are immensely grateful for. Bob, thank you for being on the Fretboard Journal podcast again.
Thank you, Jason. This is my third time, and I would say third time's a charm, but every time's been a charm so far, the first and second time. So thank you for your generosity and and having me on again.
Well, you always have great stories. You always have amazing guitars, and you always make great music. So you're an open invite guy. But
I appreciate that.
You know, this year has been obviously the weirdest year ever. And you usually, yeah, for like what, 30 years, you've been on the road with Tim McGraw?
28, but you could probably round it up to 30 because it doesn't show any sign of stopping.
Okay.
Hopefully.
Rounding up to 30. Obviously, you haven't been on the road with him because you guys usually play packed stadiums and arenas.
Sure.
And I kind of was wondering what you were up to. And then this record came in the mail, solo.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, this year has been for everybody in the business, in every aspect of the business, it's just been, but you know, if you would have told anybody, you know, in 2019 that, hey, this is around the corner, nobody would have believed you. And so for myself, I've been fortunate enough to have a boss, that has, for whatever reason, longevity or whatever, has saw fit to keep me on and keep me employed with a paycheck, and that's a rarity in town.
Sure.
And so I'm incredibly thankful for that. And so, you know, that has opened up just time. You know, I think, you know, Tim, you know, with McGraw, Tim gives me something that is actually more valuable than a paycheck, and that is, that's just time to do these things where I'm maybe not out having to figure out how to pay the electric bill, you know? So I've been doing, a lot of songwriting and learning, how to do the Zoom writing. That's, I've always liked just getting in a room with someone and writing and everything. And the Zoom thing was kind of a new take on that. But I adapted pretty well. It's not the same, but it's the next best thing. And so, I've been writing a lot and, pitching, you know, bluegrass songs and doing that. As always, just playing a lot of guitar. You know, this idea for this solo record, I couldn't think of a better name for it, you know, and you could say solo that you can't, solo, you can't hear it, you know, but, and I had been wanting to do something, and I waited kind of, you know, it was kind of a Johnny come lately kind of situation. Maybe I should have been more motivated, you know, through the year. You know, the it was a good marriage of opportunity with Collins Guitars and the release of the of their CJ45. So it was kind of it just worked out really good in that respect.
Yeah. Well, did the CJ45 inspire you to record this record?
Yeah, it kind of really did. I've always been a fan of the vintage slope shoulder guitars, as you know, the guys at Collins, Steve and Mark and Joe and Alex and all the rest of the writing shop and Bruce, the great Bruce Van Wart, I knew that this was kind of coming down the pike. And what they were doing with it. I just kind of figured, you know, they had sent me one or two before to just kind of get my opinion on them and what I liked and what I didn't like. Of course, you know, there's not much to not like about them, you know, anything Collins makes. And so, so it worked out the last one they sent me. Was just, you know, that was the one right there. As far as the prototypes, what they were locked into with that. And I figured, you know, I'd already had these songs, these little ideas that I had been just had in my brain. And I kind of figured, you know, they're going to release this guitar, and they were just generous enough to include me in their release, you know, with the video, the performance videos, and of course also the introduction of the guitar, you know, on the video they did with that, with Bruce and Clint from the shop, and my interjections on and my thoughts. So I just kind of figured, you know, I'm probably going to get a lot of traffic, you know, on my social media stuff, and I better have something ready, you know. So, yeah, that's kind of how this came about. And I took a dive and upgraded the microphones and mic pre, and thanks to Stephen Mojan, you know, Stephen Mojo, he turned me on to a guy named Brett Teagarden here in Nashville, who just makes these, you know, killer mic and mic pre's, and because I knew with it being a solo record and one guitar, it's like, how do you record that and really try to capture, you know? And I'm not an engineer, you know, I have a hard enough time playing, much less turning knobs and getting all that. But I, you know, Brett, you know, I got a pair of his PPC 125 mics, a match pair, and one of his 2100 Magic Pre's. And that was like, oh, and I got my mic position right. I'm like, well, I got the guitar, I got the songs, I got the gear now. So, so I did this all through the month of December. So,
oh, yeah. Quick turnaround.
I mean, yeah. Well, yeah, you know, I had Ginger pushing me, you know, she says, you know, just, you know, because I don't know how other guys are, Jason, but I'm just like never happy with what I play, you know? And so I had to get to a middle ground where it's like, okay, I'm going with that, and I'm hitting save and moving on to the next one. And I did most of the recording late at night, so the birds and the dogs were not making the noise. And yeah, a lot of coffee and a lot of late nights. So yeah, it was a pretty quick turnaround. But again, you know, it's stuff I already had in my head, and it's not overly produced. It's just one guitar.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So yeah. You had this sort of mic and mic preset up just kind of permanently fixed in a room, and would go to it whenever you could carve out some time in the evening?
Well, you know, the setup, you know, my little room here, and I hate to, you know, I hate to give away my advanced recording secrets, sure, but, you know, I went to Harbor Freight and bought some moving pads.
I love where this is going already. Harbor Freight reference. Yeah. Okay. Moving pads.
Yeah, man. And, you know, I have this really small area, because my library is around me, you know, that's on the walls and in the middle of the room. And I just got like this little, I mean, it would be like a walk-in closet, you know, if you had to box it in. So I got the moving pads hung up and got them clamped and everything. And, and then, started working with mic positioning. What's kind of interesting is I was talking to Mark Alphins, you know, at Collins, and I asked Mark, he was talking about Julian Lage's record, The World's Fair, which to me is like, it's one of my favorite guitar records like ever.
Sure.
You know, and how it was recorded. I think Matt Ministeri did all the producing and engineering with that. And we were talking about how one of the things was with mic placement. Julian and Matt, I think, and I don't want to misquote, I want to get it right, but the way I kind of remember was they had heard that Andre Segovia had always used a microphone close to the floor, kind of pointed up, you know, as opposed to like just at the at the fingerboard and the 12th fret, or you know, or the body and the however. So I started experimenting, and what I came up with was this mic positioning, where I had one of the mics, you know, if I'm sitting in a chair, it's, you know, below the guitar, kind of pointed up, and I'm about, oh, I'd say 2 feet away from it, distance-wise from the front of the guitar. And then another one about head level, pointed down. So it's kind of a vertical position for the microphones. And this guitar seemed to really like that, you know, that setup. And I kind of took the old, you know, the old set it and forget it approach, you know. Once I knew that was going to work, then that was the setup for every song. So that made it easy, at least for me, on the technical end, because I wasn't having to, like, make all these changes. It was just like, you know, create a new file using that template, this setup, you know, which kind of let me concentrate on playing more than trying to be an engineer, which I am not.
Yeah. Wow. So these, the Tea Garden mics, are these, quite an investment?
No, they're not really bad at all, you know? You know, and that's the thing that I think kind of has always been kind of the Achilles heel of understanding, you know, recording. It's like everybody thinks you have to have these super insanely expensive mics and gear to do these things with. And I don't think you have to, you know. These they fall into about $1,000 for a pair.
Okay, it's not bad and for a pair. Jeez.
No, yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think with recording, the way technology is today, and again, I'm just kind of a novice on recording it, but I think we're at a point, you know, and I use Studio One, you know, by Personas, and a 192 interface, nothing fancy. But I think we're at a point with technology that stuff is like so good now. If you're putting a good signal into even moderately priced microphones, and a good signal chain, you can get a lot done. And firstly, I didn't have the budget to go to a big studio, and especially during the pandemic, you know.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and and it's that thing, you know, you can make a really stellar recorded album, but then again, some of the albums that I love are kind of a little rough around the edges, you know. And I like hearing string noise or a little breath. And again, that I just kind of wanted this record to kind of like just kind of be a reflection of, you know, a guy in a room playing a guitar.
Sure.
Nothing fancy, you know. And there's so many great records out there that are already, you know, already that. You know, the stuff Julian and Critter have done, and Grant Gordy and Ross Martin, and, you know, tons of others. Simple recordings. I have a penchant for that. So that's what I do. You know, the microphones weren't that expensive. Neither was the mic pre, but there's just like super great quality, you know. And like I said, Stephen Mogen said, just get these, you're going to be done. And boy, he sure was right, you know.
That's always nice. Yeah. You're not scratching your head, second guessing yourself.
Yeah, you know, and again, you know, I would probably say I spent, man, Jason, I'd say I probably spent 4 or 5, maybe a whole week, just messing with mic placement and recording and just kind of listening, going, you know, it's, how does that sound? Because I think sometimes you can get in a rush to try to finish the project or to get something done. And I think you just need time to kind of reset your brain and your ears. You know, record something, take a break, and, you know, for a few hours or overnight, and come back the next day and listen to it and go, is that what I really heard? You know, and so that's what I did. You know, I just took time to kind of find out what the guitar liked, and what the microphone's like, and kind of went with that.
Yeah. Well, believe it or not, the Fretboard Journal now has a whole podcast on recording and mixing, so we won't go further into the weeds on this. But it is a guitar podcast, and I want to ask you, you were very gracious about the iterations of the prototypes that you saw, but what changed between that first prototype for this guitar, probably before it even had a name, and the last one? What could you feel, or what could you hear?
Just Collins is known for consistency, you know, and I think Bruce, in his mad scientist way of doing things, was looking for production consistency. You know, it's like, you know, when you, will the one next coming off the line, or at least in the prototype stages, you know, will that sound like the one before? You know, have we got it dialed in? And really that was really it. You know, there wasn't a difference per se. I think on the one that I've got, they decided on the final darker, you know, back and sides finish. But tonally, though, with the neck and tonally, they were the same, you know. And I think when you know, if I was a guitar manufacturer, that's what I'd want to look for. I'd want to, like, you know, because this guitar was really from talking to him, you know. And if you watch the interview video, you know, it's decidedly different. You know, it's not a revamp of the CJ35 that they offer. This is like a different guitar. And so, understandably, I think they wanted to hone in on, you know, when we start production, you know, the consistency in the sound and the tone and the response. And of course, you know, those guys got, you know, decades of experience with that, with Bill as well. But again, you know, being different, you want to be sure, you know, if it's a different kind of thing. So that's really all I noticed, was just, you know, it was consistent. You know, the two prototypes that I tried, man, they're dialed in and right where they need to be, you know, because you don't want to put out a batch and go, and that doesn't sound like what we expected. But, you know, Bruce is such a, he hears the wood. He lives in that wood. And he really took great pains and lengths to, you know, to get what he heard in his head and what he knew he wanted. So yeah, it was a consistency thing, and I just, you know, I just really, 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 I've always been a fan of the old vintage Slope Shoulders, and this is like I said in the video, it feels like an old guitar, but I know it's a Collins, and I don't know how to explain that. I think it's a player thing.
Yeah,
I think you got to play it. Yeah.
Well, how would you describe this? I mean, tonally, if you had to, if I made you.
Well, you know, then here you get into all that, those great terms that us guitar players try to describe stuff. You know, for me, I'm just a fan of the mid-range, you know. I like guitars that produce that super strong, fundamental mid-range. And I like guitars that have a rather quick decay in the note. You know, I love sustain, and I think in my book, sustain and decay of a note are two different kind of things. every guitar is going to have some type of sustain. I mean, obviously, because it's a wooden box with strings on it. It's going to have something. But the decay of the note, how when you hit the note, how the note blooms and then dies out. I like a quick decay. And so the tone of this guitar, you know, it's like Collins is really great at taking those old ideas and just revamping them and making something uniquely Collins about it. So, you know, does it sound like an old guitar? Yeah. Does it sound like a Collins? Yeah. It's just got that dry fundamental. And the other thing that I like about this guitar is the neck. The neck is like a full, good feeling neck. You know, and that's different for everybody. You know how guitar players are, you know. They live and die sometimes by the way the neck feels. And obviously, you know, when you pick a guitar out of the case, the first thing you feel is, well, the neck, you know. But this has that nice full neck that I've always been a fan of. And then, you know, when I play this guitar, the flat back, Bruce really went to great lengths to design that back. It's a flat back. And when I get this guitar off of me, man, I can feel the whole guitar move, which is one of the hallmarks of those great older vintage guitars. You just feel the whole guitar moving and doing this thing. And I'm always attracted to that. I just am. So, you know, I think with me in this guitar, it's an experience. And I think that's when you play any new guitar or any old guitar, you have to look at it as a sum of the parts and an experience. And this has just got that dry, responsive, the whole guitar moves thing. I could wax forever on what I think it sounds like, but I'm eager to see, you know, and hear how people respond to this when they get to dealers and can play. So, you know, it was an honor to be able to use it and be able to record it and kind of really just kind of get the first thing out there, you know? And I don't even think my recording, you know, it's one representation of it, but, you know, you really have to hear this thing in the flesh. It's a different thing. And I think it's something that guys are really going to, if you like the older slope shoulder stuff, you're going to love this one. And if you love Collins, you've not heard this before from Collins, which makes it exciting, at least for me.
Yeah. Well, one of the tunes on there, Sulfur Dell, you've mm-hmm. done that tune on a record before, right? Or part of it.
Yeah, that was on my first one. And, you know, and I figured this would be a good time just to kind of, I wanted to hear that recording kind of, that song kind of done with this guitar. And I don't know why, but I've had a lot of guys through YouTube and Facebook or not. That's like, they say that sounds like kind of like an old standard fiddle tune, you know, and I can, you know, I can, when I punch it in on YouTube or whatnot, I see other guys playing it and interpreting it. And that's, you know, it's kind of humbling. So I figured, you know what, I want to hear it on this particular guitar. And, so yeah, you know, and of course,
the difference is so striking too.
Yeah, it really is.
Was that a Martin on the first one?
No, I think that I had used a Bourgeois on that.
Okay, wow, and, way back, yeah.
Yeah, and, but I'd also played my own rhythm on the first one. And this one, so on the first version, I played rhythm and then went back, you know, and played the lead over it. And on this version, I just kind of went, you know, all in.
Yeah. You know,
and trying to cover. And, you know, really, that's just kind of where I'm at with my guitar playing. I'm just trying to become a better, you know, solo player and learn how to play the guitar in ways maybe that I didn't think about, and different, you know, different textures, and how do you approach that? And the other thing that I'm feeling too is, you know, I'm just feeling, not that I'm old, you know, I turned 55 on February 22nd. That's not old, but I will tell you that, you know, I feel different than I did when I was 45. My hands feel a little different. I can't play as fast, you know, as I did 10 years ago. And I don't really have a desire to. So I'm trying to cooperate with the ravages of time, and which I think is the secret to longevity in guitar playing, you know. You know, before the podcast started, you and I were talking about Norman Blake, and he was like one of my first, you know, besides my dad taking me to see Doc Watson when I was like 6 years old or so, you know, Norman was like the next guy up to bat in my guitar book. You know, you listen to Norman Blake from, you know, the mid-70s, and then the stuff he's put out, you know, the two albums he's put out in the last, you know, 5 or 10 years or whatever. Huge difference in the playing, but it's still Norman Blake. He's learned, I'm not saying he's learned, Norman just knew how to adapt and be himself. And I think that's what I'm trying to do, man. I'm trying to find myself, you know, and, you know, what am I going to sound like if I'm able to play 10 years from now? And am I developing skills and being sensitive to the instruments, to where I can have that kind of longevity? You know, there's some great players out there that are just like blazing, you know, and I wish I could do that. You know, I never could do that even when I was younger like that. But, you know, I think, you know, with the ravages of time, you know, speed and stamina and all that stuff for a guitar player, right and left hand, that it's going to go, you know? So I'm just trying to learn. I'm trying to learn how to play guitar all over again, Jason, and it's not easy.
Well, you had a pretty good foundation there, Bob.
Yeah. But you know, like this, like we was talking, the CJ45 guitar, it's an inspiration to me because it's like, I guess what I would say, it's a familiar, how do I sound like? It's a familiar old/new voice. Mm-hmm. It's new on one way, but it's familiar in another, and it's a new palette to work off of tonally, and the way the guitar feels and the way it responds. So, yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with all that.
Yeah, well, despite writing about guitars for the last 15 years, I'm never good at describing these things, but just that Sulfurdale comparison, you know, it just sounds, I'm not going to do it justice, but the new version is darker and it's got more going on than the old version from your first record.
Man, I appreciate that. And, you know, I like that term darker. And maybe a little more grittier. You know, I think what I'm trying to do is, I don't know. I think what I'm trying to do is just trying to get more. I'm looking for more of the essence of the song and more of an essence with the instruments and trying to meld those two things together. You know, I'm at least on this record, I'm not an over, you know, I didn't stretch out as much as I would with improv, like I would if I was playing, let's just say, like, if I had another guitar player sitting across from me, like, I don't know, like Kenny Smith, you know, if he and I were playing tunes, fiddle tunes, I would play more improv at a point. Because that would be the conversation between both of us as guitar players. And of course, your improv is really depending on who you're playing with, you know. So, but on this record, you know, I kind of hung pretty close to the melody. And what I found, even in recording too, is, man, it just, you know, I heard a guy say the public buys melody. That's what they buy. They like that. And I love improv, great improv players, you know, and again, like harkening back to Julian with his World's Fair records, like, how does he do that? You know, it's amazing. You know, David Greer's another one like that. On this one, I hung pretty close to the melody though, and it forced me to just kind of reevaluate everything, man. How I strike the string, pick position, you know, how's my right hand operating, you know, getting the right and the left hand to kind of cooperate, maybe under a microscope that I haven't had them under for a while. Yeah. So, you know, I'm just wanting to get more to the essence of what is the tone of the guitar and how do I cooperate with that? And then how do I translate that tone and the feel of the instrument into my hands, into the melody? Kind of a paring down kind of thing, you know? I don't know, B.B. King did pretty good with just a small handful of licks, but every time he hit that note, it was like, God, wow, you know? So, I don't know. I'm just trying to get to the essence of it. The Zen master approach, I guess.
There you go. We're all looking internally because of this year. And what else are we going to do? We're all getting philosophical.
Yeah. Boy, I tell you, you know, and that's the thing, you know, talking to, you know, people, you know, like my buddies at Collins or any other manufacturer, man, people are buying guitars.
Yeah.
You know, or at least for 2020, it's like maybe they found time to sit down and, get the guitar they always wanted, and since you can't go to a movie, you can't go bowling, can't go to a ball game, you know. So that's inspiring for me, you know, and I think it just harkens back to that place where there's a part of us that just, I think, is designed, and it doesn't have to be guitar. It could be, you know, watercoloring, or it could be, you know, macrame or raising a garden or whatever it is. There's just something in us that a longing, maybe we don't even know what it is or that we even have it, but it seems like a pandemic like this kind of forces us to go, how can I express myself a little differently? And of course, you know, if you're a guitar player, lucky you. Go buy the guitar you want and sit on the couch and learn how to play.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're all on house arrest, and it's made us realize what's actually important in our homes, which isn't sometimes the dumb stuff we buy from Pottery Barn or whatever. It's the stuff that actually entertains us or forces us to make music or art or whatever. Bread.
Yeah, that's right. And then I'll say this on the flip side. You know, my prediction is when live music comes back, whether that is an intimate setting with 100 people or a stadium or an amphitheater, man, I just think in every genre, we're going to see a huge explosion of live music. And I think we're going to see a greater appreciation of it, not only by, you know, the consumer, but, you know, the musicians. I've taken a lot of time this year to kind of just, you know, think about that too, you know, because when you're in the grind of being a touring musician and packing a bag and, you know, it's like on a busy tour season, I'll come home and I'll be home maybe like with like Monday and Tuesday, maybe Wednesday. I might have to leave Wednesday night, you know. And it's just like the routine of I'm on the bus doing the shows and dragging the dirty laundry home and doing the laundry and all that. And then right back out the door, it becomes this grind. And then when it's brought to like a halt and nobody can do anything, I don't know, at least for myself, it's like, I just count myself really fortunate that, number one, that I've been able to make a living playing music. And then number two, on the horizon of knowing that someday we're going to be able to go back out there and do that. I think I'm going to just, I don't think I know. I'm going to go back into it with just like so much more appreciation, you know, than I had before. And I can't wait to see what the musical landscape will be with live shows once this all comes back to whatever normal is at that time.
Well, you know, you are on the front lines and privy to probably some emails that us mere mortals aren't. Are there big ideas brewing from the McGraw camp and the other big stadium acts?
You know, I can't speak for the camp because you'd be surprised, you know, there hasn't been that discussion, you know, in depth. But I think at least in Nashville here, in country land, I think what it is when you get to bigger national touring acts, my perception is, and this is just my perception, I think we're just kind of waiting to see what the bigger engines are going to do. And by that, I mean a company like Live Nation.
Sure.
As a huge promoter, or, you know, Ticketmaster or whatever. It seems like those bridges have to be crossed first. And then once those things are in place, then, you know, we'll be able to go back, because how does liability fall? Are you vaccinated? Are you not? And if somebody gets sick, I think there's a lot of it's just like everything else this past year. It's uncharted territory that nobody's ever had to worry about.
Sure.
And, so I think we'll see touring come back in a small way, maybe. I predict mid to late year. It's going to take time to get people vaccinated. I think the Super Bowl, is a good test for this, let's see what a sporting event looks like and, you know, what's going to happen after that. Live music, man, there's just something about, it's like the old saying, musicians and singers, we've got the best seat in the house. And I think about those times, man, where I just look out and I'm just the acoustic player, but I look out and it's like, man, it's just like this in an amphitheater on a summer night. And these people are just shoulder to shoulder enjoying what you're doing. What's that going to look like? So I think it'll come back, but it's going to come back in baby steps. Here's something else to consider too. I got to thinking about this, talking with a buddy in the business. It's like, let's just say you take amphitheaters, for example. Well, number one, there's only so many of those in the country, and you can only do outdoor shows in a particular time of the year, from whatever month to whatever month. And there's only, on top of that, there's only so many Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday nights within that allotted set of months that you can do that in. So now you have all genres on hiatus. It's like, how do you, it's all kind of bottlenecked. It's like, so like, how do you decide who does what on any particular night? You know? So
a lot of things to figure out. Yeah.
Oh yeah. You know? And so, and I think bluegrass festivals, you know, that's going to be another thing that I'm, as a bluegrass guy too, on the side, that's something I'm interested to see how that's going to fall out. And, you know, what does that look like? Those are true open air events. You know, how's Telluride going to look, or Winterfest, which is indoors now. How are those kind of things going to look? And I'm telling you, man, the bluegrass guys, dude, they're ready to throw down and pick. You know they are.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. And who knows? Maybe we'll see another post-pandemic fretboard summit. I hate to put you on the spot. But
well, we were going to do one last year, so yeah, we have the space in Chicago, and hopefully the stars will align, and the talent will be able to come, and we'll make it happen sooner or later.
Yeah, such a great thing. I reflect on the generous opportunity to do that.
It was
2016
fun.
Out there. Yeah. Oh my gosh. It was just like, yeah, I walked away from that with a lot of good friendships, new friendships, and new perspective and inspiration. And I can't wait to the next one. And I appreciate all the effort you put into, I know it's no small task to get together.
Yeah, well, it was a lot of fun. It was worth it. And then, yeah. You know, it's good perspective this year. It was definitely worth it. One thing that strikes me, and I, you know, this podcast, a lot of it might sound like it was an ad for Callings, but honestly, if you had recorded all these songs with 10 different guitars, I'd still want to be talking to you. But you are an anomaly in that you seem to be inspired equally by an old Banner Gibson or a vintage Martin, as well as the new boutique handmade modern builders. And I want you to talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, I just like great guitars, and I think we're living, and I said this on the video too, I think we're living in the time of the second great wave of what will be, well, the second great wave of golden era guitar making. And I think what strikes me, and again, you know, not all new guitars, you know, do that thing for me. But what I find is, you know, the ones that it's like, I guess the easiest way to kind of describe this is that the ones that I really am drawn to that are, you know, what you would say, modern guitars, they do something like what I think the, you know, the revered vintage guitars did when they were new. You know, you look at all these old beat up Gibsons and Martins and whatever else, and you know, sometimes we forget, man, there was a time where these smelled like lacquer from the factory. Mm-hmm. And they were brand new instruments, and they sounded a particular way. And they sound, you know, after 70 or 80 years, they sound obviously decidedly different than they did when they were new. But, you know, it's like George Grin told me, I asked him about that one time a few years ago. I asked him, wonder what the old ones sounded like new. He says, well, bad does not get better. I'm like, well, he's right. So, you know, when I play, you know, whether it's a CJ 45 or whatever, if it's a really good new guitar, probably the reason I'm drawn to it is that it's doing something with the response and the way the guitar connects, not only to itself. And what I mean is, you know, that energy transference with the neck into the body, how the note blooms, and then the relationship of the guitar. How does it feel with me? The stuff that I like that's new, in a nutshell, tends to have those qualities, like I said, that I think, and I would almost bet that the old ones that we love so much, that's kind of what they did when they were new. And I think the comparison, you know, I talk to guitar buddies all the time about this. We go down the rabbit hole with this. And, you know, everybody wants to, you know, maybe everybody wants to build a guitar that does something as close to the old stuff, and so for some makers, as they can get. And I'm at a point kind of where I think that's just kind of, it's kind of impossible. It's a goal to shoot for, but I think the stuff made in the 30s and early 40s, that does one thing. And then if you make a really good guitar today, that does something different. And I'm getting to a point where the comparison between the two, you know, it's like appreciate the old stuff for what it is and appreciate the new stuff for what it is on its own terms, you know, because here, you know, I'm not going to live long enough, but in, you know, 40, 50, 60 years, there's guitars being made today that'll be playable and be considered vintage down the line. What are they going to sound like? You know, I bet they're going to be phenomenal, you know, and it might be a point where the old stuff that we, you know, the vintage stuff that we love so much, man, it just might, who knows, you know, does mahogany at, you know, at 100 years old, does mahogany have a cell structure failure and all these great guitars just start, you know, disintegrating, you know, we don't know, you know, but that's, you know, I don't know. I just like guitars that sound great, that do something in my ear. And I don't really know how to sometimes articulate that. To me, like, it's an experience. It's a personal experience with a guitar. And then how do you explain that experience? You know, it's like Tony Rice said one time, you know, it's like trying to explain how a rose smells. I don't know how you do that,
yeah.
But you smell it, you know. And I think too, the experience is different for every player. And but certainly today we're living in the next great golden age of guitar making, you know. And that's exciting, you know. And I'm talking not only for companies like, you know, Collins and Bourgeois and Santa Cruz and Martin and whoever else, you know, bigger, you know, really established companies, but for the guy who is making a small shop, you know, a guy who maybe only makes 5 or 10 a year, maybe, you know, he's got better resources, and better examples and better tooling to work with than at any other time in history.
Yeah.
And that's inspiring, you know? So I don't know. I just like guitars that I'm a guitar fan, man. I just love them, you know? And the way they sound, and when you open the case, it's a fortunate thing to be able to play guitar. You know, the older I get, I just appreciate it more, you know? And, yeah, so
And you're still in the honeymoon with the CJ45, and it might go on for years. But when you grab a guitar at home, what's the percentage of grabbing an old one versus a new one lately?
Depends on the mood I'm in. You know, you could say the honeymoon phase with the CJ45. Like I said, it has that. It's a familiar thing in a weird way.
Yeah.
I love that. But then there's times, you know, when I drag out Frankie, you know, Frankie's, you know, the old 3060-18. And I got Norman Blake to thank for getting me on that path when I was a young guy, 12, 13 years old, and hearing that. Then it's like, you know, wow, well, that does something different, you know? And I don't know. It depends on the mood I'm in, you know? They're all unique in their individuality. I think great guitars force you to, I like a guitar that doesn't make it easy on you. And what I mean by that is not that it's hard to play, in the sense of, like, you know, the action or whatnot. But I think it's good when you get to a point where you have a stable of guitars that require you to step up to bat. You know, the immediacy and the way they just kind of command, hey, you know, you gotta do this. You gotta give me something to work with, Mr. Guitar Player.
I love it.
And so yeah, I mean, it could be one of the new callings I have, which are fantastic. And then I'll pull Frankie out and go, wow, well, that's kind of a grail. You know, that's a holy grail kind of guitar. It's kind of it just comes down to the mood I'm in.
Yeah.
And like I said, they're all great.
Yeah. And Frankie, I should add, is going to make appearance in the Fretboard Journal here soon, because you did a great piece on that. And so I'm excited about that. Before I let you go, there aren't a lot of songs about luthiers. We got Mark Knopfler. He did his Mona Leone song. Maybe one day we'll be able to do a real Spotify playlist with these. But I couldn't help but notice on Solo, You paid homage to Bruce Van Wart, who we've mentioned a few times on this podcast has been on this podcast. Tell me about the making of that song and how that tribute came to be.
You know, rumor has it Bruce does not like to do a bunch of interviews.
Yeah.
And, you know, go figure.
Which is a shame, because he's great at it.
Oh, my gosh, he's incredible at it. You know, and if you look at the new video, you know, like on the CJ45 video that they put out, Bruce is letting his hair grow and he's turning into this hippie again, you know, and the mustache. And, you know, the times that I've been down to the shop and got to hang out with everybody, I try not to take too much time from any of them. You know, usually, you know, Mark will pick me up from the hotel and I'm at the facility, like, you know, all day, you know. But, you know, obviously Steve is, you know, Steve's busier than a worn-on paper hanger, you know, running the company, and Mark's got stuff to do. And so, you know, a lot of times, you know, I'll just hang out with Bruce, and sometimes he'll put me to work. You know, it's like last time I was down, you know, he says, come with, after lunch, he says, you know, come with me. And I go back there and he says, you know, help me pick out back and side sets. Okay. Awesome. So did that for a couple hours you know, just getting to know him, and having some conversation with him and learning his story, you know, and his perspective on just everything with building, you know, he he's been very generous to me with his time and his knowledge, and you know, we just kind of had a pretty good friendship. And I was kind of, you know, when he started this whole thing with the CJ45 and invited me in, and early on, and asked me what I liked about those things and my perspectives, and I'm thinking, man, why is he asking me? He's got a lot more people more qualified than me. So he kind of gave me a good shot of friendship and confidence. And so I figured this song, it just kind of felt like if I was watching Bruce do what he does, doing his thing at the wood pile, you know, picking out back and sides and or carving braces on the top. This song just kind of in my brain kind of looked like him. It kind of looked like what he does. So yeah, I had to call him, had to give him a shout out and song.
I love it.
Yeah.
Bob, thank you so much. This was so much fun. It's always great to hear what you're up to.
Jason, I appreciate you entertaining my long-winded rambling, which I am getting a great reputation for. And thanks for, you know, thanks for showcasing the record, you know. And it goes actually for, you know, it's out now on the website.
Yep.
You know, minnerguitar.com, two N's. And then it starts streaming on iTunes and everywhere else on the 5th of February, which is probably past now by the time you hear this.
Well, you never know. Sometimes I race these things
out. You never know. Yeah. You never know. But thank you so much, man. I look forward to better days and coming up to your neck of the woods and coming to the office again and hanging out and going to lunch again, my friend.
I love it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bob.
All right, buddy.